Okay, a very warm welcome to those of you who are here in the hall and to everybody at home. Really pleased to be with you this evening. And I'm so honored to offer my first Wednesday night CIMC talk. I'd like to offer my deepest gratitude to all of my teachers, known and unknown, seen and unseen. And it's because of through their open-hearted offerings that I'm with you today. And in particular, I'd like to dedicate this evening's talk to my forever mentor and teacher, Shireen Darasha, an extraordinary woman who saw my potential and aspirations long before I did, and who saw my inner goodness and reflected it back to me, a fearless trailblazer of women's education, social justice, and Dhamma practice, for whom my first daughter is named. And I brought something she gave me to show you. Objects have so much power, and I just thought it would be neat to have a part of her here with us. She's no longer alive. She gave me this one time when I was visiting her in Mumbai, India, and long before I practiced meditation, and I had gone to visit her. She was ailing and in not great health. Welcome. And we were talking, and I said to her, you know, is there anything I can do for you to help you in any way? She lived alone in an apartment building, and her answer was spontaneous, immediate. And she looked straight into my eyes, and she said, "You already are just by being you." So, forgive me. She gave me this. And then, I didn't know. I mean, I kind of thought, okay, I hope you can see it at home. Oh, it's something to rest something on. And I was traveling through Indonesia in central Java. There's ancient Buddhist site of Borobudur. And I was with my brother, and he bought me this little Buddha head. It's made out of volcanic rock. And so I found a place for that altar. And this is just a fish skeleton I found in Cape Cod as a crown. So I have this Buddha and this altar here to support us this evening. And I wanted to say that whatever I share this evening is in the spirit of what's most alive for me in my practice and from lived experience. And the big caveat is that I'm not an expert, very much a beginner, and will be on my deathbed. So my practice is unfolding as we speak, and my intention is to pass on what has been beneficial to me so that it can be beneficial for you with humility and care. So I'll speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussion so we can learn from one another. And the invitation is to consider this as a partnership or a co-creation. So please be a participant in the talk by practicing awareness internally and externally. As you take in what I'm offering, the encouragement is to be fully aware of your own breathing, your heartbeat, any sensations, thoughts, emotions that are coming and going for you. To not be a passive recipient, but really participating fully, energetically, I invite you to be here. And, you know, of course you'll forget. And so then when you remember, you wake up, you feel your feet, feel your body, and begin again. So I'd like to start by saying that the original title of my talk was going to be Outrunning the Badness. I love that title, but it had a scary ring to it. So I decided to go with the solution, which is trusting inner goodness. And it's important to consider that the way to trusting inner goodness actually requires us to fully see and know where we are, where we might be right now. And it could be that place of dread, of insufficiency, shame, or simply reckoning with pain, internal anguish, or external challenges. The Buddha's teachings invite us to be with the truth of how things are right now. I'd like to say that again. It's a key anchoring for me in my practice. The truth of how things are right now, not how we wish they should be, how we think they should be, how we want them to be, how they really are. And that's the truth. That's clear seeing. And it's also true that the life that we've lived up to now, however long you've been alive on this planet, has a certain amount of angst, a squeeze on the heart. The word in Pali is dukkha. Can you feel the ouch of it? Dukkha. It has a ugh, like a ugh. It's often translated as suffering, but it's not really an adequate translation. You know, it's that kind of uneasiness. Ajahn Chah, a teacher in this tradition, Thai forest tradition, and a beloved teacher to many of my teachers, put it this way. Peace is within oneself, to be found in the same place as agitation and suffering. It is not found in a forest or on a hilltop, nor is it given by a teacher. Where you experience suffering, you can also find freedom from suffering. Trying to run away from suffering is actually to run toward it. So let me ask you a question. Generally speaking, would you choose to be with discomfort? Be really honest. Kind of ask yourself this. Would you say to pain and anguish, yeah, let's hang out. I'd love to get to know you. Most people, including myself, I've learned, want to get the hell out of there. Our psychobiology is what determines this automatic and rapid response. It's automatic and it's rapid. This need, this push, this reactivity to get the hell out of there. Research has shown that early life, single-celled organisms expanded in warm, clear water, and they contracted and closed up when they detected a threat. Our nature, our growth, our survival depends on protecting, defending ourselves from threat. And then life happens. There's wobbles. And there's a lot of wobbles right now. I think they have been throughout time, but I think people in whichever age they live in think it's like the worst of times. So of course we want to escape, run, numb, dissociate, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, you know, all of those automatic reactions. And we've been doing this ancestrally for ages and ages. These protectors or protective behaviors have a well-meaning intention. This is not about good or bad. There's no morality here. They develop in response to life's wobbles, to dukkha. And unfortunately, over time, they become maladaptive. So trying to do too much to protect and manage our internal wounds, they go into action quickly. And often, a bag of potato chips, 3 hours of internet use, or an unpleasant argument later, we find ourselves even more exhausted, ashamed, regretful than before. While our younger, more sensitive parts remain clothed in their helplessness and misery, hidden and suffering deep within. So I've found over the years, just exploring different modalities of healing, meditation is one of them, a big one of them, that each time I come to one of these newly, I recognize that I'm just plain exhausted, completely fatigued, or as the British say, knackered. Too much running, too much avoiding of what is actually happening can leave one feeling destroyed and empty inside. And some of these tactics, to be fair, do bring temporary relief. I mean, I love potato chips. Quite delicious. But notice the word is temporary. And the thing one is running from is still there often, and after the dopamine has worn off, it somehow seems to have grown in size. I don't know about you, but I always find that it's bigger. So Adya Shanti, a well-known teacher, describes the process of enlightenment like this. Ask yourself what you're running away from. And teacher Gil Fronsdahl once told a story about a student who asked a senior monk, you know, when is a good time for me to meditate? And the monk said, when it's the better alternative. I just love this reply. I love it. Because often when students come to meditation, it can feel like something to check off on a list, you know, especially if you're in the secular mindfulness realm, like, oh, I've done my app for the day. It's a chore. It's something we have to do. Which is understandable. It's not easy. The instructions are quite straightforward. If you were here for the sitting, you may have noticed it's not so easy to actually meditate. So getting to the place where it becomes the better alternative takes consistency and continuity, and we do it especially when we don't feel like it. And when we don't feel like it's the better alternative, when you'd rather be picking the worse alternative. So in the absence of mindfulness, there's no choice, because the remember, it's automatic and rapid, that want to push away from. And most people are being pushed or hijacked by the amygdala to avoid their feelings and needs. And this is compounded. This is compounded, and it's a much harder road to walk if you've had a dysfunctional or abusive childhood, have intergenerational trauma, or have experienced any kind of trauma, whether it's big T or small T trauma. It's natural to want to slide away from pain. I want to really name that. And many of us, by nature, live in a sea of legacy burdens. You know, legacy burdens culturally, family, racism, patriarchy, homophobia, classism, to name a few. If I name them all, that's all the talk would be, naming the legacy burdens. And then we have our own personal burdens in order to survive, to get to where we are now. So of course we've had to develop these mechanisms, these protector parts or manager or firefighter parts, who knew how to manage the pain and anguish and got us to where we are. So I don't know about you, but we have been living in a pandemic. I think we all know that. And I was noticing that it feels like an extended freeze response, especially in the early pandemic. We couldn't go anywhere. We were kind of stuck. Literally stuck, and the threat level was so high, we were frozen. And it feel everything, the energetically feels stuck. So how do we then shift out of this stuckness? How do we unfreeze, if you will? How do we work with these protector parts to help them understand, to relax, to heal them, so that we can move some of this energetically? And I'd like to offer something from Thich Nhat Hanh, Vietnamese Zen Buddhist teacher, whose teachings I love and have benefited from via one of his longtime students, Dr. Larry Ward. So it's a little formula, and I'll list it, and then we'll take each one up and talk about it. So the first is to just pause. I like stop, because the rapid and automatic is so, there's such momentum of habits, behaviors, conditioning, that stop feels more appropriate. Pause seems a little gentle. So just stop. Calm is second. Rest is third. Heal is the fourth. And the fifth is transform. So let's take up stopping. One of my favorite stopping tactics, when you begin to feel those lashings of fear, of dukkha, just to stop and feel your feet connecting to the earth, leaning into earth element. You can do it right now. You know, if you're in a chair, you can feel your feet, really feeling that connection. And if you're on the ground, seated on a cushion, where the sits bones are and the whole leg structure, energetically rooting, stabilizing, grounding with the earth. There is a support that's here, and we can feel into it to stop. It requires a lot of courage to stop and to open to these feelings, to feel them, especially when one has trauma, is not so easy, or there's lack of safety. It's not so simple. So it's become a cliche, right? Feel it to heal it. And try telling that to some younger parts or protector parts who are well-versed in terror. It doesn't work. They don't believe it. They don't want to. So it's important to remember in these teachings the natural law of impermanence. You know, you noticed it in our meditation, the breath. It comes and it goes. Sounds, same thing, arise and pass away. Thoughts come and go. Emotions come and go. When we're caught in something, it's hard to see that. It's hard to see its dynamic nature. It's very easy to be drowning or totally lost or identified with it. But can we explore the energetics of it? What's happening when there's anger or excitement or sadness? We begin to see that it's not so solid. I wanted to share a story, an anecdote. So I grew up in a city called Mumbai in India, and it's a city by the Arabian Sea. And so there is a famous tourist spot called the Gateway of India. I won't go into the history of it, but it's quite interesting if you want to know how that was built by the British, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, they left us some things, some monuments. Took a lot, actually robbed, and then left a few stones here and there as monuments. So there's this place, and you can go for a boat ride, a leisure boat ride at this Gateway of India. And the boats are, you know, often rickety, and I found them to be quite scary as a young person. The interesting thing is that you have to step from this stone platform onto the boat, and there is often a wooden plank, and the sea can be quite choppy depending on the time of year. Actually, most of the time it's kind of, anyway, it's very hard to just walk into the boat because the boat moves. So alongside the boat, there are two ropes, and it's really useful for safe passage onto the boat to hold the rope. And I remember doing that, and I offer this as an analogy of trying to open to feelings, to feeling one's feelings, really helpful to have some support, some thing that can give us safe passage. So there was a rope, and then to take the boat story a little bit further, we were coming back from the boat ride, and it was docking. And, you know, the people start standing, and all of this mayhem begins to happen as we're getting closer. And the boat people are like, sit everybody, you know, trying to maintain some semblance of order. and the boat kind of, they were trying to anchor it, and it was quite crowded. And I noticed that there was a pillar where I was seated, and so I went for the pillar. And then suddenly I felt a hand on my knee, and I was like, whoa. And at this point I had been living here, and I would go back to India to visit and still take these boat rides. So I was, you know, a grown adult, and I'm like, whoa, what's that? And it was an elderly woman who was seated next to me. And I noticed that she could have held the pillar, but she chose to rest against my knee. And it was just such a tender, sweet thing. And it my instinctual response was, what the hell was that? Get away from me. And her instinctual response was to go for the warm human body as opposed to a lifeless pole. So I just offer that because this support, this resourcing is a word that from the world of psychology or psychotherapy is, how can you resource yourself to open to feeling one's feelings? And there is many, many strategies and many ways. And so as we go into the next, calm. So stop, calm. The word calm seems a little bit not as useful for me, because often people think, oh, meditation is a calm thing, and it turns out it's quite rocky or agitating. So I like the word settle. You know, really useful to get comfortable and get practiced in tracking one's nervous system. And when you feel dysregulated, when you feel you're out of your window of tolerance and you're tracking it, what helps you come back to settle back into your window of tolerance? Meditation is certainly very useful, but if there's a lot of agitation, it can be a tall ask. And so inviting you right now to consider, you know, it's very useful, or make a list after this talk, but right now to bring to mind what helps you steady and settle when things go awry. It might be taking a walk, again, feeling the feet, being in nature, five-finger breathing, mindful movement like Qigong or yoga, stretching, whatever, time in nature, drinking a cool glass of water, calling a friend, going to regular therapy, a positive memory capsule. By the way, none of this is the intention is not to run away from the difficult, but it's to shore up. It's again that rope. How can I get some support to open to this? So it's in the service of helping one align with the truth. Using the five senses, and this again brings me back to that story that I told about the woman with the hand on the knee, is studies have shown that people in more Western cultures live isolated, individualistic lives, but really shy away from physical contact in a non-intimate setting. And so one can offer it to oneself. You know, this comes used a lot in indigenous American cultures, is one hand on the heart, one hand on the abdomen. It kind of forms this reed, this root of support. And you can try it if you like. And people do this to soothe crying babies. So one can offer this to oneself. Putting a hand at the back of the neck can feel really steadying, and you know, just allowing the head and neck to feel that safety, to feel that support. Massaging the vagus nerve, which is right here, you know, just gentle tugging, tapping, acupuncture, Lots of things. I'm sure you have your wonderful resource toolkits. Yeah, allowing the face to rest, the hands on the cheeks, cool fingers on the eyes. Really good with the calming. Our third is rest. Human beings, not doings. So rest as resistance is a lot of some momentum, not a lot. Hopefully there'll be more, but to really resist this capitalist urge to be whipped into being a production machine and doing more. To just stop, to allow yourself to rest. This whole path is about, often I find myself just staring out of the window, just the simple ease of being without needing to get some experience. To just rest in your own nature. We can learn that from animals, cats. They just hang out. They don't seem to have appointments. So, resting. And even the plants model it. We live in a place where we have seasons. You notice deciduous plants and trees. They appear to be dead in winter, but they're not. There's a lot happening on the root level. So to allow one's system to metabolize and to integrate and to be with the difficult, we actually need to rest. And I'm talking about active rest, psychic rest. So practicing, what does that look like? Not going to sleep. Certainly getting enough sleep is important, and sleep hygiene, and there's a lot of people are doing this biohacking around getting enough sleep, and more power to that. But I'm talking about meditative rest. And especially important when we're so tethered to technology. Put those damn devices down. Just do it as often as you can. And I say this out loud to remind myself to do the same. It's just, the nervous system is constantly being bombarded with all this external stuff. Putting it aside is actually an act of rest. So trying that. The fourth one is heal. Boy, that's a big one. So Gabor Mate, also one of my favorite teachers, talks about, I love his work because it's such the opposite of shame and blame. It's a person who really embodies compassion. And he describes trauma as a wound and says that wounds can heal. And the Buddha in his time was said to be a healer, or people call them a doctor. And this practice has that potential. It's a tremendously healing path, a path of real healing. And to be clear and to distinguish, healing is not fixing. The automatic and rapid reactivity has an impulse to fix. And why? Because we don't want to deal with that. We don't want to deal with the messiness of dukkha. So how can I make it go away? That's the, and it's quite common in spiritual circles. So in meditation, practice if you find that you struggle with sleepiness or restlessness or craving or aversion or doubt. You know, noticing what happens, bringing some curiosity. It's suffering, so allow it to pique your interest, some curiosity, huh? Because the automatic will be aversion. You know, I want this to go away. Students will often ask, how can I make this sleepiness go away? Or as if it's something to go away, to be fixed. I wanted to share that I was in a internal family systems level 1 training, and I was talking with the lead trainer who conducted 85 trainings. So somebody who's very experienced, and IFS is a trauma healing modality. I was talking about how when I first came to meditation, and even now, I have experienced a lot of chest pain, like actual excruciating chest pain. Not all the time, and you know, it's lessened, but it's still there. And in the early years was quite intense, to the point where I would think, is this going to kill me? Like, what is going on? Really intense. And I would ask teachers about it. How do I practice with this? You know, is this normal? Like, what is happening here? And I was describing it to this trainer. And we were talking in parts language. And I said, you know, there's this part of chest pain. And even as I was talking to it, he said, sounds like you're trying to do something to it. And there was such a kernel of truth there. You know, physiologically, it's difficult to work with. And so this is not something that we're... It's hard to not fix, to not be in that fixing mode. So there's a lot of subtlety here. And I offer this example so that you can see within yourself, because we can tell these very articulate lies to ourselves that we're not trying to get rid of things, but we might be. Carl Rogers put it this way. The curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. What if we just stop struggling with the badness? Stop fighting it. Stop trying to fix it, judge it, control it. Compare it to somebody else's. What then? And I like this offering by Lisa Oliveira. Sometimes, no matter how much healing or work or growth we do, certain wounds of ours will require attending for a lifetime. Not because we're incapable or broken or immature, but because some wounds aren't penetrable by fixing. Only by continuous, ongoing nurturing, some wounds become so woven into who we are that separating from them entirely would be to separate from ourselves. The only option is to learn how to embrace those wounds with care, with understanding, with kindness. Trusting inner goodness. And so much gratitude and appreciation for these teachings of loving kindness, of metta. What does it mean? What does it mean? in some ways it's inexpressible. And I wish for you to taste it, to know it. It's innate in all of us. And we're not trying to find it or get it somewhere outside. It's within us. We're working to uncover the natural radiance of the heart. And so metta is a relational practice. It's a relational practice. It's not a feeling. It's an attitudinal commitment. What do I mean by that? An attitudinal commitment. I tell my kids, to put it in another way, I love you no matter what. No matter what. It's in the midst of, not when the sun is shining and the belly is full, not only then, certainly then, but when our inner parts, some of them might be nasty, they might be acting out, the body is drenched in shame. Then we try to remember loving ourselves exactly as we are. Accepting and allowing those parts to have their experience. Not being hijacked by them or indulging them. It's unconditional love. Bearing witness is a form of unconditional love. Ajahn Suchito, also I have a lot of teacher loves, is up there for me. A week ago, he offered this in his newsletter. Mental karma is such that even 5 minutes of neither acting on nor suppressing the present mind state results in some ease. Neither acting on nor suppressing results in some ease. It's only a start, but through doing just this and turning attention towards the witnessing, we begin to recognize a natural sanity, a seed of awakening that can steady us when the doing stops. So all that formula, it's kind of encompassed in this quote, right? It talks about stopping the doing, stopping. Neither acting on nor suppressing. Turning our attention toward the witnessing, receptive, open-hearted awareness. Equanimity, which is one of the four Brahma Viharas. The Pali word is upekha, a translation for upekha, in English, is a loving gaze, to lovingly gaze upon the unfolding of whatever is happening. Just this brings ease and a seed of awakening. How cool is that? We don't have to wait for some big light in the forest. Right now, here, it's right here, possible for each of us. Sometimes inside can feel like a desert in terms of love. So I wanted to encourage you, to do these practices, to have some, dare I say the word, faith. I know it can be charged for some, for some people. I found evidence of it in a song by the Trogs recently, British band, called Love Is All Around. I'll spare you my singing. because it's really awful. But maybe I was going to play it, but I think I'll just say it. I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. Love that's all around me, and so the feeling grows. It's written on the wind. It's everywhere I go. Oh, yes, it is. I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. Love that's all around me, and so the feeling grows. It's written on the wind. It's everywhere I go. Oh, yes, it is. It can be helpful to open to the possibility of something bigger. Of benevolence and kindness in whatever way that makes sense for you, as also a resource. And this whole business of healing and transformation, etc., you will not find it wishing life was different or in fixing. It requires a certain amount of risk. Do you really want to be healed? It requires stepping out of one's comfort zone. To even consider the possibility that each of us is a miracle, a wonder. There is a seed of sacredness in each of us, and we can see it in one another's faces. I have to share with you, I was taking a walk with my younger daughter. This was a few years ago. And I said, oh, look, a butterfly. You know, just walking in the neighborhood. And she said, it's following us. And then there was a pause. And then she said, maybe it thinks we're flowers. So it's a shift in perspective, you know, a shift in perspective. Is it possible to investigate with interest when we, in situations of suffering and distress, what is this? Rather than being the victim of whatever we happen to be feeling, we can turn it. It becomes the source of wisdom and the heart of what's happening. So bringing curiosity, Joseph Goldstein said, don't waste your suffering. It's key to waking up. It's a, in IFS, they call it trailhead. You know, it's a trailhead. I love that. It's so cool. We don't have to figure it out. We're given multiple opportunities on a geopolitical level, in our communities, in our homes, in our hearts. Lots of trailheads. And we can learn from it. It can be explored rather than it weighing on us, it weighing us down. How's everyone doing? Okay, hanging in there. Okay, I wanted to just talk a little bit about transformation as the last one of the Thich Nhat Hanh's formula. Transformation. So in secular mindfulness circles, you know, there's a lot of practicing to improve performance, etc., sleep better, focus more, get rid of anxiety. Nothing wrong with any of that stuff. Larry Rosenberg, who founded this center, I heard him describe the difference between that approach to meditation and the liberative approach to meditation. And he used the metaphor of artificial flowers versus real flowers. So artificial flowers, you know, they look very attractive and pretty, made to look that way. And they look that way forever. I mean, So one can skim the surface of this practice and get some of those benefits. Great. And then real flowers have color and texture and, you know, beautiful. Also like the artificial at first glance for the untrained eye. And then they begin to decay. They are impermanent, just like us, just like us. But that is so precious. It's so precious because there is an aliveness. There is a coming and a going. There is some reverence there. It's sacred. It's real. It's real. And that's the difference between practicing for inner liberation, for freedom. Freedom from what, you may ask? From the torments of greed, hatred, and delusion. This liberation, this enlightenment in the classical teachings is described as a cooling. And I love that, and especially that we're in summer here, a cooling of the fires of agitation. It's not, again, some big dramatic event. It's, you can almost feel the cooling of the fires of craving, of the wanting mind that gives rise to the cycle of suffering, of greed, of hatred and ignorance. So I just want to go through the formula as a reminder to stop or pause, to settle or calm, rest, heal, and transform. Okay, I'd like to, in conclusion, offer a couple of things around metta practice. So a phrase to practice with if it resonates for you. And this is the practice of unconditional positive regard. May I be loved, protected, guided, and held. May I be loved, protected, guided, and held. You can offer it to somebody else in your life who's going through a struggle. May you be loved, protected, guided, and held. And it's, this is a practice of deep listening. It's dropping in the intentionality of goodness. It's inclining the heart-mind towards it, connecting to the lovers all aroundness, and it's trusting. It's ultimately a practice of trusting. Trusting the better alternative. We all need this reminder that it's not like, oh, now we're practicing, so everything's going to be perfect and hunky-dory. It's not that, or we'll be happy forever, or things like that. It's life on life's terms. You know, it's the joys and the sorrows. We meet all of it. It's just how it is. It's just how it is. It makes the joys that much more delightful when we can cross through those fires of the sorrows. sort of to be mindful of that, you know, so we don't get into resentment when something not so great or awry happens the next day. But what we're practicing is, how am I going to relate to that? How am I going to relate to that? Trusting that one is developing the capacity to meet it with wisdom and compassion, with appropriate response, asking for help when needed, working on one's own dysfunctional patterns and habits and conditionings. Okay, so this is by Chris Germer, who teaches self-compassion. And inner trusting inner goodness is a practice of deep self-compassion. And I'd like to end with this offering by Chris. And he calls it the radical homecoming. So just taking a breath, coming back into your body. If you need to stretch, feel free to shift your posture. And just listening with an open heart. Welcome home. Welcome home to this moment, the only moment of time that we really have. Welcome home to your body and no other body without which you would not be here today. And welcome home to the many parts of your body, all of which are trying their best to promote your wishes and aspirations. Welcome home to your emotions, both pleasant and unpleasant, all of which are constantly trying to teach you something you need to know. Welcome home to the emotion of shame, the most difficult human emotion, which is also a pure expression of the human wish to be loved. Welcome home to your wish to be loved, the invisible thread that makes sure you stay connected even when everything else falls apart. Welcome home to your vulnerability, which is an essential truth of human experience, even when it scares you. Welcome home to woundedness, personal and cultural, across time and space, the invisible substrate upon which every human life unfolds. Welcome home to your fierceness, the strong arm that protects you from harm and, when necessary, demands equality and fairness. Welcome home to forgiveness and mercy, the ultimate medicine for human ignorance and human frailty, always available when you're ready to forgive. Welcome home to self-forgiveness and self-mercy, because the misdeeds of others have also taken residence within us since birth. Welcome home to your many identities, including those that have been overlooked or devalued by others. They're all precious and worthy of celebration. Welcome home to your hidden identities, your hidden parts who yearn to be loved and to be set free. Welcome home to your journey to freedom and to this particular moment, as unfinished as it is. Welcome to your yearning to be free, to the ache of feeling unfinished, of being incomplete, and welcome home to compassion, the power that surrounds us all and has the capacity to transform all that hurts and all that we are. Welcome home. I'd like to dedicate the merits of this practice, all of the goodness that we may have generated this evening with the meditation, the walking, the community, the Dhamma. May it be of benefit to all beings without exception and without question. May all beings everywhere be free of suffering. May it be so. Thank you for your kind attention. I wanted to just share this little story because I'm still processing it because I just thought it was cool. And it's on the topic of what I've spoken about this evening. I was doing some yard work, and my younger kid came running down the stairs, and bad news, bad news. It's like, oh God, I wonder what's happened. And so, you know, I wanted to have a reaction, but I used those steps. So I was just pausing, going up the stairs. What's happened? Oh, there's paint everywhere. There's paint all over the place. You know, as if she was a news reporter, like there's paint everywhere. So I was like, oh, okay. Settling, calming, feeling my feet on the ground. Of course, the impulse to shame and blame was right there. You know, how could you? Why did you? I cannot leave you for a second. All of that was right there. And I was just watching it, witnessing, pausing, settling, calming. Took a breath. Curiosity. What happened? So as we're working with our internal states, you know, ask questions. Tell less, ask questions. What happened? Oh, there was just this reckless. I was reckless. There was a reckless part that took over. Okay, reckless. And there was a willingness to engage because there was no shame and blame. So I sat down with her. I said, oh, okay, let's sit down. So what happened? Shall we ask this reckless part? What made it do these things? Pausing, you know, quiet, face crunched up. Where is the reckless part in the body? Belly. It's like, oh, how does it feel? Hot. It's in a hurry. I said, oh. Can you ask it what it needs? So we've identified its feeling, you know, how it's feeling, the texture of the reckless part. What does it need? This question, you know, what is needed right now is a question born out of compassion. What is needed? What is needed? It's hungry and lonely. Ah, okay. Okay. So, you know, to see. I mean, when you're working with these emotions, you may have heard halt. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and S is sometimes halts is sick. So check in, you know, check in with your parts, check in with your system. Bring curiosity, compassion, courage, consistency, to them, and then see what happens, see how things shift and change. Okay, so we're to the end of our evening together. I want to thank you all so much for being here, for your kind attention, and for those who are here in person, there's tea and cookies in the dining room. You're invited to stay, or if you need to go, that's fine. And everybody at home, thank you so much. It was good to see you and be with you. Be well. Okay, good night. I'll just ring the bell for good measure.